So I saw you meditating in Sariputta's cave view as we walked up on Buddha's Peak. Was it peaceful?
Yes.
Sariputta's cave. Moggallana cave also peaceful. How was Velavana? Buddha's Peak in the morning, Velavana in the afternoon, Buddha's Peak again in the evening. Most of what I will read, we've already brushed over it, but it's just nice to, now that we've been to those places repeatedly, recollect what occurred there. I was thinking, you know, what happened here in Magadha, in this city of Rajagaha, was really awesome. And we overuse that word, we use it in contexts that aren't really awesome, but what happened here really was awesome. It was epic. When you read it, it's like bigger than Ben-Hur. It's like, when the Buddha was enlightened and after he taught those 1,000 fire-worshipping ascetics, they walked from Gaya to here. So the Buddha walked here with 1,000 arahants. He walked into, like even in Thailand there are still arahants, but there's not that many, and if you see one on one occasion, it's a big deal. For me, for most of us, can you imagine 1,000 with the Buddha as their head? Now, when King Bimbisara heard that Rajagaha means the dwelling place or the seat of the Raja, Rajagaha, so the Raja was King Bimbisara. When King Bimbisara heard that the Buddha had become enlightened and was coming here with his following, 120,000 Magadhans went to pay respects. It's epic. If you made a movie about it, you'd look at it and you'd think, no, it's too much. But it really happened. What's interesting is when the Bodhisattva went forth as the prince from where he was Kapilavastu, the royal kingdom, he came to Rajagaha. And the King Bimbisara met him as a Bodhisattva, and I'll read a little bit about that as well. But it makes me think that Rajagaha must have been famous as a spiritual, I don't know what you'd call it, it's just a lot of very sincere spiritual practice, because remember the Buddha, we've just come from Gaya, 80 kilometers. There was three Kassapa brothers, one had 500 fire-worshipping Mathathera ascetic disciples, another had 300, another had 200, so you've just got this like huge numbers of summoners, 200 here, 300 there, 500 there. Venerable Sariputta and Moggallana were studying with another teacher who had 250, not too far away. So Rajagaha, I have the sense, Rajagaha must have been famous as a land of spiritual pursuit. And King Bimbisara obviously had a lot of barami and must have been very supportive of that. And it's interesting that after the Buddha had his first disciples, became arahants down there near Varanasi, he didn't try to set up his monastery or a headquarters next to Varanasi. Varanasi is like the ancient home of Vedic culture. So he kind of basically did a big detour and he came to Rajagaha because King Bimbisara had invited him when he'd just gone forth to come back and teach him. So obviously King Bimbisara had a close karmic connection with the Buddha from past lives, and everything was in place basically that his kingdom was ready to receive 1,000 arahants. Amazing. And that 120,000 people were ready to pay respects to those arahants on the first day that they arrived. It's awesome. Other things which are awesome is, you know, when you read this story, it's totally samsara. The Buddha is living in samsara. There's a certain number of right conditions, and so a lot of people can get enlightened. But even the Buddha, and I love this as a contemplation, even the Buddha has an enemy. After cultivating barami for 4 asankhyas, which is just this incredibly long period of time, at plus 100,000 eons, you would have thought that you'd make enough merit and dedicated enough merit and spread enough loving kindness to everyone. But no, there's this one guy and this is the thing, now he's sometimes called the Buddha's evil cousin. Anyway, in Buddhism we don't believe that anyone is purely evil, entirely evil, and this is important. What we believe is that evil qualities affect people's minds for periods of time, but no one is at heart evil. So Devadatta, unfortunately the Buddha's cousin, was affected by qualities such as jealousy and competition, and very badly affected, and he caused a couple of serious, you know, upsets in the Buddha's life, which the Buddha, being the Buddha, wasn't upset about. But he did make problems. And it's just an interesting thing. It's really important to understand that samsara is samsara. You can't get it perfect. Even a Buddha can't make samsara perfect. With all of his perfected perfections, the Buddha is perfect. But he still has this cousin that developed a grudge and a lot of resentment eons ago, who wants to run the community. He wants to be the boss. He wants to be as famous. He wants the offerings. And so, just as you've got the Buddha here with 1,000 arahants, you've got Devadatta up on Vulture's Peak, hiding behind a rock, waiting for the Buddha to walk past and pushing the rock down on him. It didn't hit him. It's impossible to kill a Buddha, and it's one of the results of cultivating all of that merit is that nobody can kill you. But it did cut his foot. His foot did get cut, and it did draw blood. And that was one of the things that led Devadatta to the lowest and most painful hell, which is where he is now. So after he did successfully split the community for a period of time, not long after that, apparently the earth opened up and he fell to Abhijji hell. Now this is what I was saying though about no absolute unchanging evil condition. He did build a lot of barami alongside the Bodhisattva for thousands of lives. So that's why he was able to become a bhikkhu. He had the jhanas, he had psychic powers, but then he got obsessed by this desire for gain and desire for fame, and he went off. But he will apparently, he will never meet an arahant or a Buddha again because he made such bad karma. But he will become a Pacheka Buddha. And that's just, for myself, I like these contemplations. For example, that Mahamoggallana was once Mara, a few lives back, before being Mahamoggallana. That's really interesting, you know, just for your samsaric perspective. And the fact that Devadatta will, in a few lives, after he spends a long time in Abhijji hell, experiencing the results of the bad karma, he will be a Pacheka Buddha. And that his mind will be so pure and so aloof from kilesa, and anybody that makes offerings to him or pays respects to him will be accumulating enormous amounts of merit. It's just wonderful for me. I really love contemplating that. It's like, at the same time, we have to be really careful about karma. It's very real. So whatever tendency we have to be jealous, whatever tendency we have to be competitive, be really careful with that. Don't feed it, because, you know, we're all virtuous people. We have strong connection with Buddhism. We wouldn't be here otherwise, and our connection is getting stronger. We already have a certain amount of merit, and now we're making more merit. But if you end up being a person who has barami, more and more barami, barami is energy, and you need to know how to use it. And so if you're not really, really diligent, like now, today, this lifetime, trying to weaken your negative qualities, you could become a person with barami that does a lot of damage and has to spend a long time in hell before becoming a Pacheka Buddha. So it's like, you have to be careful, basically. But I'll just read that, just kind of giving a bit of perspective. It's just amazing, isn't it? The Veluvana with 1,250 arahants, the Buddha teaching the Avada Padimokkha, up there on Vulture's Peak, teaching the most subtle dhammas to the most developed bodhisattvas. And then on the other hand, you've got Devadatta trying to push a rock on him, getting the royal elephant drunk and releasing the elephant to chase after the Buddha. Just, you know, the stuff of samsara. All good stuff. He came and went, so it was more like a retreat place for him. So I think I'm not sure exactly how long he spent, but there's many places. There was the mango grove that the doctor gave, Shivaka, gave to him, and there were other places that he stayed in this area. Yeah, for coming and going. And then later he moved more to Jetavana and Savatthi. But I think the first 6, 7, 8 years was mostly in this area. And he came back also between Magadha. What was the other kingdom? Kosala, where King Prasenadi was the king, and Magadha and Kosala. Since we're in Rajgir, the seat of the Raja, I'm just going to read a little bit about that. Just the first meeting of King Bimbisara with the Bodhisattva. It's written in verse, and it's the Buddha talking about that occasion. Now I will tell the going forth. Now he, the mighty seer, went forth. Now he was questioned and described the reason for his going forth. The crowded life lived in a house exhales an atmosphere of dust, but life gone forth is open wide. He saw this and he chose the going forth. By his so doing, he refused all evil action of the body, rejected all wrong kinds of speech, and rectified his livelihood besides. He went to Rajagaha town, the castle of the Magadhans. There he, the Bodhisattva, went for alms. With many a mark of excellence, King Bimbisara from within his palace saw him passing by. And when he saw the excellence of all the marks, "Look, sirs," he said, "how handsome is that man, how stately, how pure and perfect is his conduct. With downcast eyes and mindful, looking only a plough yoke's length before him, he is no lowly lineage. Send the royal messengers at once to follow up the path the bhikkhu takes." The messengers were sent at once and followed closely in his wake. Now which way will the bhikkhu go? Where has he chosen his abode? He wanders on from house to house, guarding sense doors with real restraint, fully aware and mindfully. He soon has filled his begging bowl. His alms round is now done. The sage is setting out and leaves the town, taking the road to Pandava. He must live on the hill of Pandava. Now when he came to his abode, the messengers went up to him, though one of them turned back again, to give the king the answer to his question. "The bhikkhu sire, like a tiger, or like a bull, or like a lion, is seated in a mountain cave, upon the eastern slope of Pandava." The warrior heard the runner's tale, then summoning a coach of state, he drove in haste out of the town, out to the hill of Pandava. He drove as far as he could go, and then descended from the coach. The little distance that remained he went on foot till he drew near the sage. The king sat down and he exchanged greetings and asked about his health. When his exchange of courtesy was done, the king then spoke to him these words, "You are quite young, a youth, a boy in the first phase of life. You have the good looks of a man of high-born warrior noble stock, one fit to grace a first-rate army, to lead the troops of elephants. I offer you a fortune, take it. Your birth, I ask you also, tell it." "There is a prosperous country, sire, and vigorous, right up against the foothills of Himalaya, inhabited by Kosalans, whose race is named after the sun, whose lineage is Sakyan, but I have not gone forth to seek sense pleasures. I have gone out to strive, seeing danger in them, and seeing safe refuge from them in renouncing. That is my heart's desire." So apparently King Bimbisara then offered him his kingdom. He was offering him a military post, and he said, "Okay, well, take my kingdom." And the Bodhisattva replied, "No, I'm seeking the deathless. I don't want the kingdom." Lumbini and Kapilavatu are quite some way away, and when the Buddha went forth, the Bodhisattva went forth, he came to Rajgir. We're in a special place. We talk about civilizations, and we talk about the cradles of civilizations, but I see this area of Magadha in terms of civilizing the mind, isn't it? This was a place of civilizing the mind. This is a place of spiritual evolution. And King Bimbisara obviously stewarded that. He must have been a patron to any number of spiritual seekers. So that when the Buddha returns with 1,000 arahants, everything's in place. The royal kingdom and the noble friends of the king are ready to support. And they embrace them and they support them. So the next thing I'm going to read, the Buddha has just taught the 1,000 matted hair fire ascetics, and then they were liberated. The last two lines of that sutta says, "And while this discourse was being delivered, the hearts of the 1,000 bhikkhus were delivered from taints through non-clinging." So 1,000 more arahants. Now when the Blessed One had lived at Gayasisa, so that's where we were the other day when we were meditating in the place where Sujata offered the milk rice, and we had a look over the wall and we could see the banks of the Naranjara River. It was in this area that sermon was taught. And when the Buddha had lived there, as long as he chose, he set out to wander by stages to Rajagaha with a large following of bhikkhus, with 1,000 bhikkhus. With all the former matted hair ascetics, wandering by stages, he at length reached Rajagaha. and there he stayed in the sapling grove at the Supatita shrine. Sena Bimbisara, king of Magadha, heard, "It seems that the monk Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth into homelessness from a Sakyan clan, has come to Rajagaha and is living in the sapling grove of the Supatita shrine. Now the good name of Master Gotama has been spread thus. That blessed one is such since he is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in knowledge and conduct, sublime, the knower of the worlds, the incomparable leader of men to be tamed, the teacher of gods and men, enlightened, blessed. He makes known this world with its deities, its maras and its divinities, this generation with its monks and brahmins, with its princes and men, which he has himself realized through direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the meaning and the letter, and he explains a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. It is good to go and see such accomplished ones." So that was the Buddha's reputation already, before he's coming to town. And you can imagine that 1,000 ascetics have all gone forth under the Buddha, just 80 kilometers away. This would make ripples. People would hear about this. Now, what this phrase uttered by King Bimbisara on this occasion, I don't know who said it first, but basically this is chanting in our morning chanting every morning. We say these exact phrases. So it's just nice that when you do this chanting, it's nice to know that it has this origin. It's drawn from this. Basically, all these things that King Bimbisara is saying about the Buddha before he walks into Rajaka, he's accomplished, fully enlightened, arahato, samma sambuddhassa, okay? And perfect in knowledge and conduct, vijja charana sampanno, loka vidu, the knower of worlds. All of these phrases that we chant. It's just nice to know that that morning chanting that we do has this 2,560 or so year origin, and we chant it in the same language as well, that these people were probably speaking or very similar. So Bimbisara is keen to go and pay respects. He said it is good to go and see such accomplished ones. Then accompanied by 12 hosts, by 120,000 of Magadhan Brahmin householders, Sena Bimbisara, king of Magadha, went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side. But of the 12 hosts of Brahmin householders, some paid homage to the Blessed One, some sat down at his side, some exchanged greetings with him, and when this courteous and formal talk was finished, sat down at one side. Some pronounced their name and clan in the Blessed One's presence, and then sat down at one side, and some kept silence, and then sat down at one side. They wondered, does the great monk lead the holy life under Uruvela Kassapa, or does Uruvela Kassapa lead the holy life under the great monk? But the Blessed One became aware in his mind of the thought in their minds, and he addressed the Venerable Uruvela Kassapa in stanzas. So this is one of the Kassapa brothers, the leader of the 500 Matthavira ascetics with his two brothers. So the people in Rajgir would have known of Uruvela Kassapa. He would have had his fame. And they're wondering now, here's the Buddha, here's the Uruvela Kassapa, who is following who? What did he see, the lean teacher who dwells at Uruvela, that he left the fires? I ask of you this question, Kassapa, how did you come to leave fire worshipping? Sights and sounds and tastes and concubines are the rewards promised for sacrifice. Of worldly things I saw they are a stain. Then worship and sacrifice gave joy no more. But if your heart finds no delight in these, Kassapa, said the Blessed One, in sights and sounds, even in tastes as well, what then delights your heart here in this world? Of gods and men, Kassapa, tell me that. I saw the state of peace not of this world, where is no owning and no sensual being, no otherness, no being led by others, then worship and sacrifice gave no more joy. So this is very profound. I saw the state of peace, not of this world, where there is no owning and no sensual being, no otherness and no being led by others. Worship and sacrifice gave no more joy. Then a Venerable Uruvela Kassapa rose from his seat and arranging his robe on one shoulder, he prostrated himself with his head at the Blessed One's feet, saying, Lord, the Blessed One is my guide, I am a disciple. Then the 12 hosts of Magadhan Brahmin householders thought, Uruvela Kassapa lives a holy life under the Blessed One. The Blessed One, aware in his mind of the thought in their minds, then gave them progressive instruction. At length, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dharma arose then and there in 11 of the 12 hosts of the Magadhan Brahman householders. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation, and one host became adherent. Okay, so leaders of large clans, 11 out of 12. I would assume this means it just attained Sotapanna. I was talking about Ajahn Anand had said in his Dharma talks that after things were established here, it was about 20% of the population of the kingdom were Sotapannas. Pretty amazing. And it's, you know, it makes sense. You've got 1,000 arahants walking in. That was the beginning. They all had their disciples. Sariputra and Mahamoggallana came in, and then they, you know, then the efforts at generating the sasana and getting people established in paths and fruits, that's when things really took off. Those two were like, they called the marshal of the Dharma. They were, you know, it was quite a movement. And so it made sense, really. 20% were at least Sotapannas, and we must have had a lot of arahants. Even where this hotel where we're having this talk, I'm pretty sure, would have been part of the Velavana. It would have been a huge bamboo grove. It's just 500 metres that way. So we go out that way and then we come back. It's actually just over there. So we're in a holy land. Well, we're talking about... Ajahn Anand often talks about noble wealth. He talks about worldly wealth. Thai people these days quite committed to worldly success, more materialistic than a few decades ago. And he's often telling them, you know, the real wealth that you want to be interested in is the Arya Sat, which is noble wealth, which is an internal wealth. And he says that's the most precious thing, and you need to cultivate it by being generous, by keeping the precepts, by meditating. So in terms of a civilization, this was an epicenter for inner wealth. We come now, we can't see, we can see a few rocks, which was the fort of Magadha. We can see those rocks. We can see some terracotta bricks where monasteries were, but there's no, in terms of incredible ruins, there's not much to look at, is there? And many of the people that really benefited have already gone to Nibbana. But what happened though, and this we need to recollect, is that this noble lineage of teachers teaching disciples and disciples teaching their disciples went to Malaysia, Australia, Ireland.
I don't think so.
Well, there are. Well, Buddhism is there, isn't it? Buddhism is there. The Buddha's teachings are in every bookstore. And it's like, but basically, this, originally it was an oral tradition. People memorized texts. And people taught from their experience. Later on it became written down. But basically it started here. And so we're making a pilgrimage to the heartland where it all began. And, who felt peaceful meditating in the Velavana? Yeah, or two heads nodding. Who felt peaceful meditating on Vulture's Peak? So if you look at those people who are trying to sell you flowers, and you look at those people who are putting the money on the shrine, trying to fool you to think that you should give money, so that when you walk away they put it in their pockets.
That's right.
The peaceful feeling is not coming from them, and it's not coming from the guy with the sari. So where is it coming from? What occurred then, you imagine thousands of arahants. I said this before, when you walk into Wat Nong Phapong, where Ajahn Chah, one bhikkhu, is believed to have become an arahant, you can feel something. Something, an energy is in that forest. It's not just because Ajahn Chah became an arahant there, it's also because there's a large community of monks who keep precepts and meditate every day. So there's several things happening. But certainly in places where people do get liberated, where their minds are purified, an energy seems to stick to that place. You could probably feel the same thing in Buddha's monastery and Ajahn Anand's monastery. And here, even with the relative coarseness of downtown Rajgir, which is just over that wall at the Velavana, all those beggars and all those trucks and buses and all the dust. Tonight I got back, the first thing I did was wash every piece of clothing I was wearing and myself. in the bathtub. I just like, we were out in the rich, holy dust of Rajagiha for about 7 hours today, and the colour of the water is black, you know? I've never had black washing water quite as black as in Bihar. Anyway, but what is it that when you're meditating, you know, despite the filth, despite the noise, despite the coarseness, there's something here, isn't there? You all felt some special energy. Yes. So it's a special place. We don't need to go to a museum. We don't need to look at statues. We don't need to look at scriptures. We just kind of meditate and you feel this place was about meditation. This place was about purifying the mind. And thousands of people, tens of thousands of people did. Which is, it's really wonderful that you can come here and feel that. I myself have been here several times, so none of this is new. But I always feel, when we went up to Vulture's Peak this morning and I did my first bow, I wept. Just when my head touched that ground, just with a sense of, there's a sense of coming home. There's nowhere quite as spiritually charged, I don't think, as Vulture's Peak and Bodh Gaya. For myself, that's how it feels to me. So when I put my head on that concrete, there's a feeling of something here I really love, really cherish, really aspire to realize, and it's like you get so close you can smell it or you can taste it or something. We meditate and we taste it with our mind, don't we? We smell it with our mind and we feel a little closer. But what this does to your faith faculty is really helpful for you in the future. When you leave here, you're just going to feel a deeper connection with the Enlightenment tradition. So it's a really good thing to do. And that we've gone to Velavana a couple of times, and that you meditate in Sariputra Mogalana's caves, and then offer flowers, and go to Vulture's Peak a few times. So when you go home, you can recollect these places. You'll have a feeling of connectedness. And many people experience this, that when they go home, just recollecting meditating in the holy sites brightens their minds. And this is a really beautiful gift that you've given yourselves, because we all come up with challenges, we all come up with struggles. And so sometimes it gets a bit dry, and there's just weighed down by the stuff of life. And then we train ourselves in recollecting the good things that we did that was inspiring, and it lifts our energy up again. You don't have to be here to recollect how inspired you were, and you don't have to be here to just remind yourself that spiritual pursuit has its rewards, that the paths and the fruits of spiritual practice are real. Millions of beings have realized them. Talking about this, and just talking a little bit about this, the phenomenon Vulture's Peak, how many other people feel when you're up there that it's aloof from the world? Does anyone else feel that?
Yeah.
Basically everyone. Does anyone else feel that it's close to heaven? Because I do. It's actually just a few hundred meters high. But when you get halfway up that staircase, something happens energetically for me. You just feel elevated. And then it feels aloof. And then when you're on that actual peak, you feel close to heaven. So for me, it's like, I have no doubt that the Buddha taught thousands of devas there. It's a perfect place. And there's a wonderful space element, you know. You could imagine 10,000 devas listening to a Dhamma talk there. Really nice.
Is there always a haze there?
Sorry?
Is there a haze? Is that always there?
I don't think so. I think in the time the Buddha was there, it was mostly forest. And I think the haze is that people cook with cow excrement.
Mm.
Yeah, so everybody is cooking with cow excrement. There's a particularly acrid smoke.
Yes, that's true.
And then there's the road traffic as well, stirring up the dust.
and a bit of mist, probably.
But a little bit in the morning.
Because you get the impression that it's a separation from the earth.
Right. Down below is thicker
and
up there.
The haze and the sky, that section, separates from the lower section.
You're above the haze.
You're above it.
Being above the haze, it's nice, isn't it? Anyway, I love it. I love Vulture's Peak. What I'm going to tell you now, it's not related to Vulture's Peak, but it's kind of related to Vulture's Peak. This is private information. Ajahnanan said that at Sarnath, which is where we're going in a few days, in about a week, when the Buddha taught the first sermon, Anya Kondanya was the first human Sotapanna. I asked Ajahnanan, were devas listening? He said, yes, many. And he said, I asked him, did any of them become enlightened? And he said, yes. I asked him how many. He said, how many do you think he said? He said, millions. Now, I don't think he would make that up. It's not emphasized in the suttas that you can become enlightened as a deva. And it makes sense. If you do your dharma and you keep your precepts and you meditate a lot and you have a disposition where you love the dharma and you've listened to a lot of dharma and the merit of that got you reborn in heaven, of course you're going to have an inclination to. It's also in the suttas that when the bodhisattva left to see to heaven, the devas of the dharma timsa were dancing joyfully and brandishing banners and celebrating, because they knew Tushita is above dharma timsa, they would have seen him come down. And they knew the bodhisattva has been reborn, he's going to be the Buddha. Indra came and asked them, what are you all singing and dancing for? The heaven of the 33, the other ministers. And they said, the bodhisattva has been born, he's going to be a Buddha. We're rejoicing because it's going to be an age of great light. So the devas, those that rejoice in goodness, know about the bodhisattva, and they know that he's been reborn, and they know that he's going to be enlightened, because they have divine eye, some capacity to be aware of what will happen in the future as well. So why wouldn't, and then when the Buddha got enlightened, there was this light that spread through the heavens and the hells and lit up the whole of conditioned reality. And if you were a deva and you love goodness, you would notice that. And you would look down and say, oh, Lord Buddha's enlightened now. And you would see that Brahma Sahampati came down to talk to the Buddha. You would notice that. Brahma Sahampati being like the next radiant thing after the Buddha in the universe. and you would probably listen to the conversation. It would be a very interesting conversation, wouldn't it? Conversation between the Brahma and the Buddha. And so the Buddha's explained he's enlightened. But he's not going to teach it. It's too subtle. And then the Brahma Sahampati says, some people will understand. Please teach. He reviews the world. He says, they will understand. Okay, I will teach. So if you're a deva, and if you've been a Buddhist in your past lives, and you know there's a Buddha, and you know he's agreed to teach, and you know he's formulating the way he's going to teach, you would be following him, I would think. And so it makes sense to me that Anya Kondanya had made a specific vow. He wanted to be the first person in the human realm to be enlightened, so he became a Sotapanna. Apparently, in that first sermon, millions of devas also attained to Dhamma. Whether you believe that or not, doesn't matter, but I do, and it's encouraging. And it makes sense. If you think of the time that the Bodhisattva spent cultivating the Bharani, millions of lives, there has to be a similarly grand result. You know, all those beings that build auspicious karma with him, millions of lifetimes, cultivating virtue, many of them would be in heaven as a result of that virtue. And many of them would be right to listen to teachings. And so, why not? And I ask Ajahn, because it's often said, it's not written in the suttas, but it's often said by monks, devas can't realize Dhamma. It's best to practice as a human. Now, it is best to practice as a human if you are a human. It's a good situation between heaven and hell. You can contemplate pleasure, you can contemplate pain, you can contemplate aging, you can contemplate, you know, degeneration of the body. It's an excellent situation for contemplating impermanence and that flux of feeling. So it's a very good situation, and it is good that people go. And I think one of the reasons realizing Dhamma as a deva isn't emphasized is because the Buddha doesn't want us to be heedless. If you're a human being and you've met the teachings now, practicing now is what's going to make you right to realize Dhamma as a deva if you do get reborn as a deva. But you have to have that inclination, because the subtlety and the pleasure of the heaven realm is better than it is here. And we all know that we can get deluded by pleasure, distracted by it. So if you don't have this love of Dhamma and this love of practice and this aspiration to realize something better, you can get very distracted by sensual pleasure. So it's not encouraged to aspire to be reborn as a deva and to try to realize Dhamma as a deva. But I think it's the result. If you're very, very sincere in your human practice, you get born as a deva, but you have this tendency to... You know, the whole point of what I'm saying this is, I also believe that millions of devas were enlightened at Dolce's people. I think so. I don't have Ajahn Anand's perspective. But I think so. And I think that's part of what we can feel out there. This beautiful energy that's just there all the time. And whether you believe that the Vajrayana began there, that's a personal choice. But Vulture's Peak is celebrated by all of the Buddhist traditions. In the chan, the Shirangama mantra, the chan tradition is huge. That was said to have been taught there on Vulture's Peak. And the Prajnaparamita, which is a huge, I think, Tibetan monks in the Gelugpa tradition anyway, I think they spend 4 years studying Prajnaparamita Sutta. It's years, which Manjushri and Maitreya came in visions of monks at Nalanda, which is where we're going tomorrow, by the way, to Nalanda, and reported, this is what the Buddha taught on Vulture's Peak to us. So if you understand that Manjushri and Maitreya are 10th level bodhisattvas, so this is what our Buddha was when he was a prince. He's a 10th level bodhisattva. The bodhisattva bhumis have 10 levels, and it takes millions of lives to get there. And so you understand that it makes sense to me as well. Like, personally, I don't doubt it, and I don't try to force others to believe it, but I don't doubt it. Even though my teachers are arahants and I have enormous respect for the Theravada tradition, I don't doubt that highest level bodhisattvas would come to receive teachings from the Buddha. Of course they would. That's what they're aspiring to be. And I don't doubt that the Buddha wouldn't be able to explain the most subtle explanations of emptiness and wisdom. What else would they talk about? What would the Buddha talk to high level bodhisattvas about, other than the highest wisdoms? So anyway, for me, I just rejoice about in the activities of Buddhas and the activities of bodhisattvas and the activities of arahants. And just since we mentioned Nalanda, we're going there tomorrow. The Theravadins is the hometown of Sariputta, and his relics, I think, are still in the stupa, the big stupa. You heard it from that picture, Sariputta stupa. And it's also the place where Sariputta attained final nibbana, and it's a great story. His mum was a Brahmin. She didn't have any faith in the Buddha at all, even though her son is like the foremost disciple with as much wisdom as the Buddha. She had no faith. But she's a faith type, but she wasn't impressed by wisdom. So the son realized, I've helped millions of beings attain to arahantship, but my mum still has no faith. Anyway, so Sariputta realized, this is one thing I haven't yet accomplished. Of all the things I've accomplished, I haven't yet helped my mum. So he decided to go and die in her home. And what happened is Indra came to pay respects to Sariputta because he saw that he was going to pass into final nibbana, and then so did a Brahma day, Brahma. And the mum obviously had enough sensitivity to see, oh, who was that? That was Indra. Oh, well, who was that? That's your Brahma. That's your beloved Brahma. So, but he came to pay respects to you. That's right, mother. And the mother became a Buddhist before he died. So anyway, that happened in Nalanda. I mention that because we're going to Nalanda. I'll do a little bit more reading. This is about the two chief disciples. Since we were meditating in a cave where Mahamoggallana spent Kamsa, and a cave where Sariputta attained enlightenment. Back to the Savakas, back to the Theravada. The occasion was this. The wanderer Sanjaya was living at Rajagaha with a large following of wanderers. With 250 wanderers, and Sariputta and Moggallana were living the holy life under the wanderer Sanjaya. They had made a pact that whichever of them first reached the deathless should inform the other. Now it being morning, the venerable Asaji dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went into Rajagaha for alms. His manner as he went inspired confidence, whether in moving forwards or backwards, looking ahead or aside, bending or stretching, his eyes were downcast and he moved with grace. The wanderer Sariputta saw him thus as he was begging for alms in Rajagaha, and he thought, there are arahants in this world, those who possess the arahant path, and this bhikkhu is one of them. Suppose I approach him and ask under whom he has gone forth, or who is his teacher, or whose dhamma he confesses. But then he thought, it is not the time to ask this bhikkhu while he is wandering for alms among houses. Suppose I follow behind him to trace what the seekers have discovered. When the venerable Asaji had finished his round, he left Rajagaha with his alms food. Then the wanderer Sariputta went up to him and greeted him. When this courteous formal talk was finished, he stood at one side and he said to him, "Friend, your faculties are serene. The colour of your skin is clear and bright. Under whom have you gone forth? Who is your teacher? Or whose Dharma do you confess?" "There is a great monk friend, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan. I have gone forth under that Blessed One. He is my teacher. It is that Blessed One's Dharma that I confess. But what does the Venerable One's teacher say? What does he tell?" "I have only recently gone forth, friend. I have only just come to this Dharma and discipline. I cannot teach you the Dharma in detail. Still, I will tell you its meaning in brief." Then Sariputta said, "So be it, friend. Say much or little as it suits you. Tell me but the meaning now, for I need no more than the meaning, with no thought of details yet." The Venerable Asaji told the wanderer Sariputta this sketch of the Dhamma. "The Perfect One has told the cause of causally arisen things, and what brings their cessation too. Such is the doctrine preached by that great monk." Now when the wanderer Sariputta heard this statement of the Dhamma, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in him. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. This is the truth. Even if that were all, you have attained the state where is no sorrow, that we for many times, 10,000 ages, have let pass by unseen. Sariputta the wanderer went to Moggallana. So you get that. It's very brief, but it's very important. Paticchasamuppada, we were chanting it, we've been chanting it, this is what the Buddha contemplated. We had another reading, what he was contemplating under the Bodhi tree, the causes of conditioned experience and undoing the causes, leading to liberation. In brief, the Buddha talks of causally arisen things and what brings their cessation. That's all Sariputta needed to hear. Things which have causes to arise have causes to cease, and he became Sotapanna. Sariputta the wanderer went to Moggallana. The wanderer Moggallana, the wanderer saw him coming. He said, "Your faculties are serene, friend. The colour of your skin is clear and bright. Is it possible that you have found the deathless?" "Yes, friend, I have found the deathless." "But how did you find it, friend?" Sariputta the wanderer told what had happened. When Moggallana the wanderer heard the statement of the Dhamma, "The Perfect One has told the cause of causally arisen things and what brings their cessation too. Such is the doctrine preached by the great monk." Then the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in him. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. So they had a pact that whoever should find the deathless would come back and teach the other. So now, the same four-line verse, and Mahamoggallana is also Sotapanna. It's interesting that Asaji said, "I am new to this Dhamma and discipline, I cannot teach you the Dhamma in detail." He was an arahant. He was one of the first five disciples that the Buddha had taught the Anattalaka Sutta to. But he was very modest, evidently. Another reason to read this is because the Blessed One was in the Vellavana when Mahamoggallana and Sariputta went to meet him there. So this is a story. Moggallana said, "Friend, let us go to the Blessed One. The Blessed One is our teacher. But friend, these 250 wanderers are living here depending on us, looking to us. They ought to be consulted first. They will do as they think fit." So they'd been living with Sanjaya and his 250 followers. They went together to the wanderers and told them, "Friends, we are going to the Blessed One. The Blessed One is our teacher. We live depending on the Venerable Ones, looking to them. If they go to lead the holy life under the great monk, then we too will do the same." So Sariputta and Moggallana went to Sanjaya, the wanderer, and told him what they were going to do. "Enough, friends, do not go. Let us three guide this community together." For the second and for the third time, they told him the same thing and received the same answer. Then Sariputta and Moggallana went with the 250 wanderers to the bamboo grove, and hot blood gushed from Sanjaya, the wanderer's mouth. The Blessed One saw Sariputta and Moggallana coming in the distance, and when he saw them, he told the bhikkhus, "Here come these two friends, Kolita and Upatissa. These two will be my chief disciples, an auspicious pair." Then it was that the Master announced them. They who were already liberated in the domain of profound knowledge, in the supreme destruction of the stuff of existence, before they had reached the bamboo grove, saying, "Here come these two friends, Kolita and Upatissa. These two will be my chief disciples and auspicious pair." Sariputta and Moggallana went up to the Blessed One and prostrated themselves at his feet. They said to him, Lord, we wish to have the going forth under the Blessed One and the admission. Come, bhikkhus, the Blessed One said, the Dhamma is well proclaimed. Lead the holy life for the complete ending of suffering. And that was those Venerable One's admission. Now at that time a number of well-known Magadhan clansmen were leading the holy life under the Blessed One, and people disapproved. They murmured and protested, the monk Gotama is creating childlessness and widowhood. He is obliterating the clans. So many people are inspired and going forth. Already 1,000 matted hair ascetics have gone forth under him. When they saw bhikkhus, they mocked them with these stanzas. Gotama the monk did come to the fort of Magadha. He led away all of Sanjaya's band. Whom will he lead away today? The bhikkhus heard this and they went to the Blessed One and told him. He said, this affair will not last long. It will only last 7 days. And at the end of the 7 days it will subside. So when people mock you with this stanza, you can reprove them in return with this one. They lead by Dhamma, who are great heroes too and perfect ones. And when they thus lead by Dhamma, where is the ground for jealousy? So when people mocked them, they reproved the people in return. Then people began to think, monks who are sons of the Sakyans lead by Dhamma, it seems, not against Dhamma. And the affair lasted 7 days, and after the 7 days it subsided. The elder Moggallana attained arahantship 7 days after going to the Buddha. The elder Sariputta passed a fortnight in reviewing and analyzing with insight all levels of consciousness. Venerable Mahamoggallana, within 7 days, finished his work, and not only finished his work, came out of finishing his work with the same amount of psychic power as the Buddha, equal to the Buddha in psychic power. So that meant there's occasions where the Buddha and Mahamoggallana become aware of a conceited thought from a Brahmadeva, and they both fly to the Brahma realms together to teach him. So that kind of mind-reading capacity, pretty amazing. And Sariputta took 2 weeks. The reason Venerable Sariputta took longer is he's the foremost in wisdom. He had to understand every knowable Dhamma, which took 2 weeks. After having trained for one asankhya and 100,000 eons. So reviewing it all so that by when he got enlightened, he understood every Dhamma. That took him 2 weeks. And his final arahantship was realized while listening to a sermon taught by the Buddha to someone else in that cave. So you can imagine where we were meditating, Lord Buddha. It's not enough room to stand, but you could see that monks could sit. And the Buddha's sitting, teaching another person. Sariputta was fanning him, keeping the mosquitoes away. And as he listened, he got the final attainment. So isn't it nice to have been able to offer flowers and meditate in the cave? Lord Buddha became an arahant. And meditate on the mountaintop where Lord Buddha taught the devas. And walk down possibly the same path where these great beings went for alms, food. And tonight to sleep in the place where the bamboo grows with the 1,000 arahants. I'm not going to have many days like this just like that. Happy for you all. I rejoice in your good karma and your increasing good karma. May it lead us all to great insight and liberation.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you.
That was very nice.